Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Friday, March 8th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, the state Senate is advancing an education funding bill, but it's very different from what House lawmakers have already passed. Then we tour a clinic that's offering in vitro fertilization services. Plus, a Mississippi student is recognized for her poetry. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Mississippi lawmakers in both chambers want to change the state's education funding formula, but disagree on how to get it done. House lawmakers have proposed a replacement formula through their Inspire Act that passed the chamber earlier this week. And now, Senate lawmakers are passing a bill that would simply modify the existing Mississippi Adequate Education Program, which is the current funding formula. Senate Bill 2332 moves through the chamber with unanimous support minus two present votes. Republican Senator Dennis DeBar of Leakesville chairs the Senate Education Committee. When presenting the bill, he told fellow lawmakers that this would keep much of the existing system intact while modifying some key points.
We're amending the 40% base student cost to 25%. When we calculate the formula, we're amending it from 40 to 25%. That is something the superintendents have said has been what they've been doing anyway, so we're just reflecting what is currently happening. And that's the inflationary index in non-recalculation years. We recalculate every 4 years. I believe the next one is in 2027. We're amending the rate of inflation because base student costs, there's an inflationary index. And currently, you take the previous year's inflation rate. What we're doing is taking the 20-year average. That gets a better overall picture of inflation over time. Just this last year, it was 4.1%. If it was just last year, under the 20-year average, is 2.6%. We're amending the local contribution. Basically, districts get their share minus the local contribution rate. Currently, it's the lesser of 27% or the value of 28 mils, 28.7% of their share of their MAEP allocation. We're increasing that 27% to 29.5%. Most, if not all, districts are paying into, I guess, 29.5% or higher, so this really doesn't harm any districts either.
The bill will also set up some new stipulations on how these funds can be spent. DeBar says part of the change is to prevent funds from being overspent in areas that don't have a major impact on student learning.
Basically, we're stating that 90% of the contributions to MAEP must be spent on expenses other than superintendent, assistant superintendents, principal, and assistant principal salaries. This is the same language we included in the education appropriations bill last year. If you recall, we were able to put in $100 million extra into education, but it was subject to that term that I just read off. It only could go to basically us to get money into the classroom and not into administrative expenses. Lines 356 is the second term we've added. And what that does is it's currently This really affects JPS. It's something that Dr. Green has brought to us as well, that if a child leaves a public school, hence moves to a public charter school, and then decides to return back to that public school, then the charter school has to return a pro rata share of their MAEP allocation back to that public school.
Leaders in the House want to see more significant changes in the state's education funding formula. MAEP has been around for over 20 years, only fully funded twice. With the Inspire Act, they want to write a new formula based on a system that sets a standard dollar amount for each child that is then weighted depending on their individual needs and allows lawmakers to adjust funding every year. Republican House Speaker Jason White says this would result in a system that funds schools more each year than the Senate's plan.
Inspire overhauls the current funding formula, known as MAEP, with a transparent, student-centric model. This new formula establishes weighted student funding, a formula that bases the amount a school or district receives on the needs of the student rather than historical spending or teacher units. Weighted student funding starts with a base amount of $6,650 for every student and then adds other additional dollar amounts based on the student's identified needs. Those weight categories include low income, English learners, special education, gifted students, career tech education, concentrated poverty, and sparsity.
The House plan would increase education funding by $240 million, while the Senate plan would increase by $210. With that $30 million difference, White thinks the Inspire Act is the best choice for lawmakers.
A vote against the Inspire Act is a vote against increased education funding by over $200 million. House Bill 1453 is proof that the Republican-led House is serious about funding public education in our state in a way that is transparent and student-centered. It is time to once and for all acknowledge that the MAEP formula is a thing of the past. Very few understand it, and it certainly has not been followed.
Both bills now advance to opposing chambers. Coming up, we tour a clinic that's offering in vitro fertilization services. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
The Radio Reading Service of Mississippi provides print-impaired Mississippians with news, information, and entertainment. To learn more or to see if you qualify, call 601-432-6301.
No matter if you use an app to start your car or still have a flip phone, Everyday Tech can decipher today's technology for tomorrow's solutions. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or the MPB Public Media app.
The Radio Reading Service of Mississippi provides print-impaired Mississippians with news, information, and entertainment. To learn more or to see if you qualify, call 601-432-6301.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. While many IFV clinics in Alabama have halted services following a state Supreme Court ruling, providers in Mississippi are still operating. At the Mississippi Reproductive Medicine Facility based in Flowood, patients are meeting with doctors and medical practitioners to discuss how they can move forward with having children using in vitro fertilization.
Okay, I'm going to see a couple of patients, and you just call me when nobody's
Dr. Mary Gephardt is a fertility nurse practitioner at the clinic. She's been there for more than 10 years, helping hundreds of patients on their journey to get pregnant. We sat down with her to ask about what IVF does, how it works, and why it's becoming a major topic for reproductive rights.
So in vitro fertilization is IVF for short. That's what we call it, and it is assisted reproductive technology. And it's basically where we take the egg outside of a person's body from the ovary, and then we fertilize or attempt to fertilize that egg with a sperm in our lab. And once that egg is fertilized, we culture that fertilized egg through an embryo stage where we can hopefully be able to transfer it back to a patient once it becomes a blastocyst in hopes that she will become pregnant.
And what was that last word you said?
A blastocyst.
What does that mean?
So it is a stage in the embryo development where it has the potential to become a pregnancy and hopefully become a baby.
And you know that when you are going through this process, which ones have that potential?
Well, you don't know it. And so that's why we would stimulate a woman's ovaries during a month, a particular month. So those eggs are going to be lost one way or another. She's either going to ovulate, or those eggs, if she doesn't ovulate and we don't use those eggs, she loses them for that month. So during an IVF cycle, we actually stimulate her eggs to mature as many as we can so that we can try to retrieve those eggs from the ovary for that month. There is always a fair amount of attrition from the number of follicles that grow in the ovary. So basically the egg lives within a follicle. And you can't see an egg on an ultrasound. We can only measure the follicle, which is its little home. And so if a patient should have, say, 20 follicles, when we actually do the egg retrieval, we may only retrieve 16 eggs from those 20 follicles. And not all of those eggs are able to be used. They're either not mature or they might be degenerating and we can't use them. But the ones that we can use, we attempt to fertilize each of those eggs. Not all eggs are going to fertilize though. So once we inject an egg with a sperm, we look the next day in our embryology lab to see which eggs have fertilized. That's usually about 80% or so of those eggs will fertilize. So we might have gone from 16 eggs down to 14 eggs. Then we expect roughly about half of those to grow out over the next 5 days or so to actually become an embryo. So that number is constantly decreasing. So you might end up from the number of eggs that you retrieve, then the number that are fertilized, then the number that actually grow to become an embryo, that number is decreasing. And then once you get to that point, that stage of development, depending on the age of the patient, some of those embryos are going to be abnormal. And we can actually test those embryos at that time to determine which ones are normal and which ones are abnormal based on their chromosomal makeup. The younger a patient is, in general, the more normal embryos she's going to create, the older a patient is, the more chromosomally abnormal embryos she will create.
What brings a woman in to see you? What are the circumstances?
There can be a lot of reasons why a patient needs in vitro fertilization, or even if they're not needing IVF, but just needing the help of reproductive medicine. A third of the times it's related to a female issue, a third of the time it can be a male issue, or a third of the time it can be a combination of the two. There are financial challenges.
Very expensive.
Very expensive.
What are we talking range-wise?
In general, I usually tell people to consider about $20,000, and that's going to include their medications, their monitoring, their ultrasounds, their lab work, the procedure-related costs with the egg retrieval, anesthesia, culture in the lab, creating the embryo, and then oftentimes biopsying the embryo, lab cost with testing the embryo to determine those chromosomal abnormalities, and then planning for an embryo transfer, which is transferring the embryo back to the uterus.
Does insurance cover any of this?
In general, no. We are seeing a few insurances beginning to cover. Some federal policies are beginning to cover the procedure, and then some independent insurances are beginning to cover it.
Down the hall from her office are several rooms to perform routine checkups, an area for ultrasounds, and the semi-sterile operating room where they collect and later implant embryos. This part of the building is overseen in part by embryologist Kayla Fountain. The room is prepared with a positive pressure system to prevent any outside particles from damaging embryos.
So this is the retrieval room in here. They have, that's the machine down there that they used to retrieve with.
That's pretty small.
This is the thing that they would hook up to the needle. So they use this little foot pedal, and the foot pedal is a suction that aspirates the follicular fluid from the female patient.
And that whistling sound you hear is the pressure system. On the wall is a small opening where vials of embryos are passed through into their lab. A collection of microscopes and other medical equipment line the walls.
So we take the eggs and we have freezing media that we use. So the freezing media that we use is Irvine, and we put it through a process that basically dehydrates them. And we use a little cryolock, which is similar to a rapid eye, but a cryolock just has a little, it's just a small little plastic cryo device, and it has a little scoop on the end. And just above that little scoop, there's a black line. So we know exactly where to place the eggs on there. And normally we freeze 3 eggs at a time onto 1 cryo device.
And then where do you store them?
So our storage room is actually behind this door. It is secure back there. We keep
and we can't go in there.
No. So it's behind this locked door, and then that room back there, there's also another door. It does not lock, but it's behind a separate
room. So it's like freezing cold in there?
Not the whole room, but we do have these metal containers called Dewars, and they all have liquid nitrogen in them. We check the tanks every other day just to make sure they have a certain level in them, to make sure they stay below, I think it's like 130 negative Celsius. So when we freeze them, after we put that media and the eggs onto that straw, we put it directly down into the liquid nitrogen. We put a little cap on it and screw the cap on it, and then that goes into a separate cane. And the cane has identifiers for that patient on it. It'll have the day that we cryopreserve the eggs. So that'll all go down. It stays in liquid nitrogen. We put a cap on that cane, and then that cane goes into a specific Dewar, into a specific spot in that Dewar.
So you have a lot of them back there.
So we actually have 1, 2, we have 6 back there. And then we also have a dry shipper for any backup if we freeze sperm or anything, and we are waiting on their FDA labs.
Despite all their efforts to protect the embryos, Gephardt emphasizes it's just not possible to ensure each of them remains viable.
What I know, based on what I see every day and what I understand from the scientific information, is we are not good enough to create an embryo that is going to create a baby every single time. It just does not work that way, unfortunately. From a biological standpoint, there are embryos, whether they're created without IVF, whether people are just creating an embryo the old-fashioned way versus going to a lab to having an embryo created, they're just not always successful. Embryos don't always implant. Even those that implant can turn into a miscarriage. We expect about 1 in 4 pregnancies to be a miscarriage. 70% of the time, a miscarriage is related to a chromosomal abnormality. So even patients that aren't coming to see us for interventions, they can still have miscarriages or losses or just not get pregnant from embryos because all embryos don't implant and all embryos don't turn into a baby, unfortunately. So we know what we're doing in the lab. It's not feasible to consider that every single embryo would make a child. I wish we could do that. I would love to be able to tell patients that, and it would make our job easier probably because everyone would know that it's going to be successful and that everyone who comes here to have a baby would be leaving with a baby, and that would be good. But unfortunately, we're just not there yet.
That's Marty Geppert at the Mississippi Reproductive Medicine Facility in Flowood. Alabama legislators just passed a law to keep IVF accessible. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. A Pascagoula high school sophomore has won the 2024 Mississippi Poetry Out Loud competition and will soon compete on the national stage. Melissa Taylor of Pascagoula was one of dozens of students who participated in the competition the statewide. She recited three poems, Mansplaining by Jennifer Militillo, I Felt a Funeral in My Brain by Emily Dickinson, and Burning in the Rain by Richard Blanco. Our Kobe Vance sits down with Melissa following her big win.
I'm excited because I know this is going to open new opportunities for me, and I get to go to Washington, D.C.
So what was it like being able to be on stage and share your poem?
At first, it was nerve-wracking, of course, but once I got used to it, everything flowed out smoothly, and I was proud of myself for getting up there and doing what I did.
Can you give us a sample of what your poetry, of your poem that you recited, whichever is your favorite?
I like Mansplaining.
Go for it.
Okay. Dear sir, your air of authority leaves me lost, eases me from a place of ease, contracts with my contradictions to take from me a place. Autopilots my autobiography, frightens my fright, sighs at my breath, wins at my race.
Wow. What inspired you to recite this?
The emotion put behind it, you could get it from reading it, that the writer put in the poem. You can tell the emotion. And I feel like that I could have portrayed that well, so I just picked it, and it worked out.
Was there anything about the message of that poem that stood out to you?
Yes. I feel like the message of that poem was basically a woman telling a man about himself, like all the wrongdoings and the things that he can do that a woman can't, and just basically making herself known and her presence known.
What were your emotions as you were reading it and, I guess, waiting for the results?
It was my first poem, so I was pretty nervous reciting it, and waiting for the results for everything was so nerve-wracking. It's like they made it long and drawn out on purpose. So,
what were your thoughts being able to hear the poems from the other contestants?
I thought everybody did amazing. You know, I was like, I got some competition because everybody was just so good. But yeah, I'm glad that everything worked out.
So you will be representing Mississippi in the National Poetry Out Loud. What are your thoughts? How are you feeling right now about having that opportunity?
That is a big thing. Representing Mississippi, you know, and we need some recognition right now, some good recognition. And I'm happy that I'll be the one doing that. So,
what got you interested in poetry to begin with?
I liked how you can relate to certain poems and how you can feel the speakers and authors' emotions while reading it. Yeah.
What was it like being able to make it your own, to be able to put your voice into something that might have already been written, but now you get to add on layers?
That actually is my favorite thing about reciting poems, is that you can, the work is already there, but it's up to you to give that emotion to portray whatever the speaker is trying to put into that poem.
I'd say it's probably only halfway there, considering the medium. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with folks? Any words of advice for young Mississippians who might be looking to get interested in poetry?
Mm-hmm. I would say just go for it. That's what I did. I'm not very confident in speaking in front of people, and I still went up there and did my thing, and it worked out perfectly fine for me. So just not even about poetry, anything in general, I would say just do what you want. You know, because you can do it.
Melissa Taylor is a sophomore from Pascagoula High School. She's the winner of Mississippi's 2024 Poetry Out Loud competition held here at MPB in Jackson. This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.